Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Stoa Nova Conversations. I'm your host, Massimo Pigliucci from the City College of New York, and here's my co-host, Rob Coulter from University of Wyoming. Hi, Rob. How are you doing?
Hi, Massimo. Hi, everybody. Glad you could join us today.
How is the weather there these days?
It's lovely today, actually. Sunshiny and warm.
Okay. What do you mean by warm? Because I don't trust Wyoming
probably,
people.
Yeah, so I think it's probably in the 40s.
Okay. All right.
The air is short weather in Wyoming.
Yeah, in Brooklyn here is on the chilly side. It's like mid-50s. Anyway, so we're going to get an interesting conversation going in a minute. But before we do that, I'm going to announce the next episode of the Stoa Nova Conversations. It will take place on Sunday, May 9th at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. And we will have the pleasure and honor to talk with Anthony Long, who is one of the major scholars in modern Stoicism, and particularly about Epictetus. And so we'll talk about Epictetus, we'll talk about criticisms of Stoicism, sometimes even coming out of unusual quarters, such as people actually have published translations of Marcus Aurelius, but I'm going to leave that one there. And if you are interested in our conversation, participate in our conversation with Anthony, you go to meetup.com and look for the Stoa Nova and sign up so that you get the Zoom link. If you're interested in watching past episodes of the Stoa Nova Conversations with Rob and myself, then you go to the Stoa Nova YouTube channel and look for the Stoa Nova playlist. That said, today's topic is Marcus Aurelius, because today is Marcus' 900th birthday, which explains Rob's rather unusual attire.
1900th. You missed it. You missed it.
1900th. That's right. Oh, yes. That's right. What did I say?
900th.
So. Oh, my gosh. Yes. We're short of only a millennium. What do you want to do? 1900th anniversary of the birth. So we're going to do what we're going to do here. There is so much to cover and we only have about an hour. We'll do what we can. But I'm going to start with just reminding people a little bit about the basic facts about Marcus Aurelius. And then Rob and I can launch in our conversations. I have some of my favorite quotes from Marcus that are, you know, three or four of them that I'd like to talk about. If we have time, we're also going to address the standard questions about Marcus Aurelius. Why did he, you know, did he in fact persecute the Christians? Why did he not abolish slavery? And more important, most importantly and common of all, why the hell did he pick Commodus as his successor? So, before we get to all of that, the basics. Marcus was born 26 April 121 current era and died 17 March 180. He was one of the so-called five good emperors, more formally referred to as the Nerva Antonine dynasty, together with Nerva, Trajan, Hadrian, and Antoninus Pius. Marcus was chosen by Hadrian, actually, as a future emperor. And because of his character, and even very early on when he was young. And in fact, Hadrian instructed Antoninus Pius to adopt Marcus as his son so that he would be in the line of succession, which Antoninus in fact did. During his reign, Marcus had to fight a couple of frontier wars, one on the east against the Parthians and a couple in the north against the German tribes. All of these were wars of containment, not expansion. The Roman Empire had reached its apex, basically, it's under Trajan. And Hadrian had made the decision that, you know what, enough is enough. We're good as it is. And so we're just going to hold on to what we have instead of, you know, expanding further. And so Marcus was following the same in the same general idea. Nevertheless, he had to defend the empire from a couple of frontier wars. He also handled and very likely died of the Antonine Plague, which killed 5 million people in the empire between 165 and 180. It's apparently the worst plague of antiquity. And he also had to handle a rebellion by one of his lieutenants, Avidius Cassius. And in all of this, you know, he behaved in a very interesting way, and I would say certainly in a stoically informed fashion. So that's the basic about Marcus Aurelius. Rob, you want to start with some of the stuff that struck you as interesting about Marcus?
Yeah, I'd like to do that. Yeah, so we each have picked a few passages that we think are, well, for me anyway, my criteria were which ones, what are some of the ones that have been most sort of influential in my life? And when I think of the ancient Stoics and Marcus Aurelius, One of the things I like best about Marcus as a reader of ancient philosophy and as a teacher of Stoicism in particular is that Marcus, for me, evinces a real humanity. Right. I see in reading Marcus, I see a man who is not perfect, even though he's the most powerful man in the world at the time. I see a man who struggles with his own journey, you know, incredibly well educated, practiced in all these Stoic principles. And of course, he was educated in all the important philosophical schools of the era and chose Stoicism as his guide to life. But to see him struggle with actually applying the Stoic ideas in his life, as he does so often throughout the Meditations, for me is a really humanizing feature of Marcus that speaks to me quite a bit.
Yes, I agree. He's definitely one of the most approachable in Stoics in that sense, because you really see the struggle. I mean, let's not forget, of course, that the Meditations was not meant for publication.
Right.
It was his personal philosophical diary, which is one of the reasons it is misguided to criticize it as it is often done, on the basis that it is redundant and preachy. Well, of course, it's redundant and preachy. He's preaching to himself,
right,
to become a better person. And he's redundant because he dealt with the same problems over and over, just like the rest of us.
Exactly. Which is, you know, when I read Epictetus, I feel like I'm getting yelled at a lot of the time. Whereas with Marcus, I feel like a fellow traveler.
Yes, that's right.
But I thought I'd start with just reading one of the passages.
Yeah. Go for it.
And this is book four, number 49. Be like the headland, with wave after wave breaking against it, which yet stands firm and sees the boiling waters round it fall to rest. Unfortunate am I that this has befallen me. No, quite the contrary. Fortunate am I that when such a thing has befallen me, I remain undisturbed, neither crushed by the present nor afraid of what is to come. For such a thing could have happened to anyone, but not everyone would have remained undisturbed in the face of such a blow. So why is this a misfortune rather than something fortunate? Or do you generally say that a human misfortune can lie in something other than a deviation from man's true nature? And do you suppose anything to be a deviation from man's nature if it does not conflict with the will of that nature? Well, then, you have learned to know what that will is. Can what has happened to you prevent you in any way from being just, high-minded, self-controlled, prudent, deliberate in your judgment, empty of deceit, self-respecting, free, or prevent you from possessing any of the qualities that, by their presence, make it possible for man's nature to come into its own? So henceforth, in the face of every difficulty that leads you to feel distress, remember, apply this principle. This is no misfortune, but to bear it with a noble spirit is good fortune.
Yeah.
Right. So I like that. That one, it speaks to me about individual fortitude. Right. So how am I to react in the face of difficulties? Marcus is not here proclaiming that he is totally impervious, right? He puts up the headland that has the waves crashing up against it as sort of an aspirational image. This is what I would like to be like. This is what I aim at. But nonetheless, throughout it, he talks about feeling distress when those waves crash into him, but reminding himself that those waves, as well as my own distress, are part of the plan, part of nature. Right. And in no case do those things prevent him from being just and high-minded and self-controlled and so on. He gives us a whole list there to remind us. And then finally, there's that turn that, no, this is no misfortune. Rather, to bear it well is good fortune.
Yeah, so, I like that one. The first one that I have on my list is fairly short. It's from Meditations 850. And it says, a cucumber is bitter, throw it away. There are briars in the road, turn aside from them. This is enough. Do not add, and why were such things made in the world? And this has been very useful for me lots of times, right? Because it's like, basically what he's telling you is, look, the world is the way it is. That doesn't mean that we cannot change. I mean, you know, as you know, one of the problems with Stoicism is that often it is misunderstood as a quietist philosophy. And which is nothing, you know, anything but. But the thing is, certain things cannot be changed. There are bitter cucumbers in the world, end of story, right? So you only have two choices. You either eat the damn cucumber or you stay away from the cucumber. But to go on and complain about, you know, why are there such things as bitter cucumbers in the world, that's complaining for no particular reason. It's just going to make you feel bad about the whole thing. The same goes for aspects, of course, more importantly than cucumbers, for aspects of human nature, right? When, you know, we know that some people are going to be nasty. In fact, that's one of the other quotes that I'm going to bring up in a minute, you know, nasty and, you know, backstabbing, et cetera, et cetera. Well, that doesn't mean you have to take it. But at the same time, it does mean that you need to realize this is the way things are. And you can certainly try to change what you can change, what's in your power to change, but complaining about something that you cannot change is really a waste of emotional energy and time. It's like, and so it refocuses on, in a sense, it's what a lot of Epictetus is about, refocuses your attention on where your agency is maximized, right? What is, given this particular situation, what is the, that where is it that you can act? Sure, if you can act in a way that completely alters the situation for the better, great, go for it. But if you don't, and your choice, if you can't, and your choices are more restricted, then, you know, do what you need to do or what you prefer to do, but don't just complain about things. All right, you go next.
Okay, that's a good one. I do love the image of the throwing away the cucumber. It's very straightforward.
The interesting thing is I have a friend who actually is very sensitive to cucumber's taste. They are in fact very bitter for her because she's a super taster. And so to tease her very often, I bring up this thing. It's like, well, you know.
Just throw it away. Well, on complaining, interestingly, I also chose one that's related to that, mm-hmm. I think. And that is book 10, number 3. Everything that happens either happens in such a way that you are fitted by nature to bear it, or in such a way that you are not. If then it comes about in such a way that you are fitted by nature to bear it, make no complaint, but bear it as your nature enables you to do. But if it comes about in such a way that you are not fitted by nature to bear it, again, you should make no complaint, for it will soon be the end of you. Remember, however, that you are fitted by nature to bear everything that you can render bearable and endurable through the exercise of your judgment, by suggesting the idea to yourself that your interest or your duty demands it. That one is really sort of personal to me. Oh, losing my party hat. And I think about that. Everything, I say this to myself on a regular basis, or a paraphrase of it, right? Everything that happens is either going to be such that I can get through it or I can't. If I get through it, then I will have figured out a way to get through it, whatever the difficulty is. And if I can't, well, then I won't be around to complain much anyway. So, and then the advice on how to make it bearable is to think about my interest and my duty. I think about that in terms of, oh, for example, a thing I wrote about for modernstoicism.com, I had a medical emergency across the planet. Right. And I literally said to myself while I was in the hospital awaiting surgery that all this is going to be such that I either get through it or I don't. Mm-hmm. And there's no point in complaining either way. Yeah, and right. I found this very personally useful for me in that way.
Yeah, I recommend actually to our viewers that essay. It's really an interesting application, a poignant application, I would say, of, you know, practical stoicism. Yeah, one of the things about these kind of passages and this kind of talk, again, is that it often is unfortunately misinterpreted as quietism, right? When you say, well, don't complain, right? Then regularly, whenever I post something like this on social media, I regularly say, well, who are you to tell me I shouldn't complain? Well, first of all, I am not telling you personally not to complain. Second of all, I am not actually telling you anything. I'm just quoting Marcus Aurelius or Epictetus for that thing. But the notion of, more importantly, the notion of not complaining, this isn't to, it's, I don't understand why so many people interpret it merely as, oh, I shouldn't be trying to make things better. It's like, no, that is not the point at all. The point is not to aggravate yourself emotionally by starting to dwell on the alleged impossibility of doing something or the alleged badness of a situation and so on and so forth. It's for your own help. It's for your own psychological help. That doesn't mean you shouldn't do anything about it. I'm pretty sure when you were sick down under there, the first thing you did was to, in fact, go to the hospital, right? You tried to do something about it. You didn't say, well, what the hell are you complaining about? If you die, you die. If you don't die, you don't die. It's like, no, right?
I was saying that to myself in surgery prep. Yeah. Right. So I had handed over my future to the surgeons. Yeah. No, that's exactly right, I think. And the end of that passage I just read, I think, highlights that, right? You can endure things if you know that your interest or your duty demands it of you, right? So this is, I'm thinking here in parallel with a term that comes out of like the military, I think. At least that's the context in which I've heard it, about embracing the suck, right? So this is, I remember saying to myself laying in the hospital in the worst pain of my life saying, but this is really going to suck, but I'm going to get through it, right? Yeah. And it wasn't about giving up. It was about walking through it, not acquiescing or any of that. So, and our duty often demands stringent action of us that Marcus was well aware of, right? You know, he wrote these things, much of the Meditations at least was written, you know, on the battlefield in a time of action when he had to make choices about moving forward. And it wasn't merely acquiescing in inactivity, for sure.
Exactly.
So that's right.
Well, my next suggestion is from Meditations 2.1, and it's a classic. Probably people have heard of it, and I'm actually reading only a part of it, but the full quote is certainly worth taking a look at. Begin the morning by saying to yourself, I shall meet with the busybody, the ungrateful, arrogant, deceitful, envious, unsocial. All of these things happen to them by reason of their ignorance of what is good and evil. I can neither be injured by any of them, for no one can fix on me what is ugly, nor can I be angry with my kinsman, nor hate him. There is so much into this quote that is unbelievable. I mean, that could be, if anybody were to ask me, you know, how do you summarize Stoicism? That's it. That's that individual quote is, you know, tells you 90% of what you need to know about Stoicism. That is, so let's parse it a little bit by little, right? The first part is similar to the cucumber quote. Like, well, there are such unpleasant things, unpleasant people around. That's just a fact of nature. That's a fact of life. This is going to happen whether you like it or not. So you need to be prepared for it because, as Seneca also reminds us often, a prepared mind is one that deals better with a situation, right? If you don't expect certain things to happen or certain people to behave in a certain way, then you're taking it back and you don't know how to respond. And more than likely than not, you're going to get angry. And be ineffective in your response. Instead, Marcus is saying, look, this is the way it works, so be ready, right? Don't fool yourself, basically. Start out the morning and say, okay, this is likely what's going to happen. And by the way, let's remember, this is the emperor talking, right? If anybody were to show himself too much of a busybody, ungrateful, arrogant, deceitful, envious, or unsocial, he could have lost his head, right? So this is the kind of, and yet he's saying, you know, that's okay. These people are like that, and you can bear with this situation. Then he immediately says, and this is the part that I found in my experience, people have the most trouble relating to people that practice Stoicism. All these things happen to them by reason of their ignorance of what is good and evil. This comes actually from Socrates. In one of the Platonic dialogues, this famous phrase like ignorance is the root of all evil. Now, when you say something like that, people say, what do you mean? You mean that the people that are non-educated, don't have a college degree, are evil? Or do you mean that people don't know what they're doing when they do evil? No, it doesn't mean any of that, because the kind of ignorance that Socrates and then now Marcus is talking about is ignorance of what is good or bad, or what is truly good or bad, right? People, the notion is that people always think when they act that what they're doing is good, either good in general or good for them or good for their families or deserved, whatever it is. Even the worst person you can think of typically thinks that way. You know, there are not many people that go around like Disney cartoon villains who wake up in the morning, go in front of the mirror and say, whoa, 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 what kind of evil can I do today, right? Even horrible people, you know, dictators, you know, perpetrators of atrocities and genocide and stuff like that, they had reasons for why they were doing what they were doing. And they thought that good, those were good reasons. Of course, they were horribly mistaken, but that's a completely different point. In fact, that is the point that Marcos is making there. It's like, they don't know what they're doing. This is not, by the way, just Stoicism. This is also in Buddhism, very clearly. The Dalai Lama has been on record as saying, you know, Hitler was a bad knot in the karmic web, and he needed to be excised, but, you know, it also needed to be pitied because he didn't know what he was doing. He didn't know better. This is done also, of course, this is true also from the Christian tradition, right? When Jesus says on the cross, you know, forgive them, Father, because they don't know what they're doing. That's exactly the same kind of sentiment. So this is not typical only of Stoicism. And then Marcus goes on and says, I can neither be injured by any of them, for no one can fix on me what is ugly, nor can I be angry with my kinsmen or hate him. So he says, you know, whatever they do, it's their business. It's not under my control. Now, of course, if I can avoid injustice to be done, I should act, but they cannot fix it on me, right? They cannot, in fact, convince me to do evil on my own, because that is up to me. That's entirely up to my faculty of judgment. And it is, therefore, my responsibility to make my own decisions. I cannot be just, you know, influenced and directed by others. And then finally, he says that the bit about cannot be angry with your kinsmen. He's basically reminding himself that, look, we're all in the same boat together. We're all human beings. We're all fallible. We all make mistakes. At some time or another in our life, we all think that something is absolutely right, and in fact, it turns out to be wrong. And, you know, hopefully not many of us actually act in a horrible way on these kind of misguided beliefs, but we all have them. And so to remind ourselves of this is to remind ourselves that we are in a cosmopolis of brothers and sisters, and that we should treat them accordingly. Yes, they can make mistakes, sometimes even horrible mistakes. And yes, it is our duty to counter those mistakes if it is possible, or to avoid them in the first place. But we also need to understand that this is the way humans work, and accept that as a fact of the world.
Nice. Yeah, I like that passage a lot. I didn't choose it because I kind of anticipated you would, because as you pointed out, it's a classic. That's one when I teach Stoicism in prisons. Uh-huh. That passage is. We usually start with that one when we start with Marcus. And boy, often those prisoners light up when they see that, right? They're like, oh, I know that guy. Or some of them are even more like, yeah, I am that guy.
Right? Speaking of prisons, I see that we had Ben in among the viewers in the room. And he's going to be one of our guests, I think, in September. Talking nice. About programs in Stoicism in prison. So just a shout out for that. We'll talk about that particularly. Do you have another quote for
I do. I do. I wanted to go back to the idea about duty.
Mm-hmm.
And that is in book 5, number 1, which speaks to me in a number of ways. But early in the morning, when you find it so hard to rouse yourself from your sleep, have these thoughts at hand. I am rising to do the work of a human being. Why, then, am I so irritable if I'm going out to do what I was born to do and what I was brought into this world for? Or was I created for this, to lie in bed and warm myself under the bedclothes? Well, it certainly is more pleasant. So were you born for pleasure, or in general for feeling, or for action? Do you not see how the little plants, the little birds, the ants, the spiders, the bees, each do their own work and play their part in the proper running of the universe? And will you then, for your part, refuse to do the work of a human being? Will you not hasten to do what your nature requires of you? Yes, but one needs one's rest too. Quite so, but nature has set limits on that, as she has on eating and drinking, and yet you are going beyond those limits and beyond what is sufficient. But when it comes to your actions, this is no longer the case. But there you stop short of what you could do. The truth is, you have no love for yourself, or else you would love both your own nature and all that your nature wills. So, I mean, there's a little more to that passage, but I'll just stop there, right? So one of the things I enjoy about that passage, by which I mean, by which I feel called out by on that passage, is sometimes I don't want to, do my, what I know my nature is calling me to do. And Marcus apparently had that problem some mornings too. I'm reminded in that passage both of my own nature and the fact that I'm embedded in a much broader natural system, and using nature in the Stoic sense, right? That as a rational being, I have some lovely duties that I'm called to do. And most of them involve getting my butt out of bed, which sometimes I'm reluctant to do. And so that's another one of those passages where I really identify with the humanity of Marcus and the imperfection of Marcus as a progressor and not holding up the image of a sage in this case. Right.
Nice. Okay. I got two more. So I'm going to go with the next one.
Okay.
That's from 627. They are certainly moved toward things because they suppose them to be suitable to their nature and profitable to them. But it is not so. Teach them then and show them without being angry. So this is essentially builds on the previous quote that I mentioned. This is the notion that, again, people do things because they think that they are right. They think that that is the right thing to do. They think that it's profitable for them to do certain things. Even when those things clearly are either against the law or against accepted morality or whatever it is, people think that they're good for them for whatever reason. They convince themselves that that is the case. And so it's interesting that Marcus is engaging in a little bit of dialogue with himself here, right? He imagines himself, say, raising the objection, but it isn't so. You know, it was that they're mistaken. It's like, well, all right, they're mistaken. So just explain to them, right? So teach them without getting angry. That's the bit that I come back to. It's not only we have a duty to explain things, you know, to help other people, just like, of course, we want to be helped in the same way by other people, but you want to do it without being angry. And to me, that's a quote that I remember almost every day I get on social media, because, you know, I make a fairly large use of social media in terms of outreach of, you know, putting out there not only stuff about Stoicism, but also about my other major passion, which is the pseudoscience, as in the study and criticism of. And of course, I get all sorts of responses from, you know, people from all over the world, which is part of what makes it an interesting thing, right? It's like, you know, every day that I'm on Twitter or Facebook, for all the limitations and problems that those platforms have, I feel like I'm literally having a conversation with the world, you know, people that I don't know who have been maybe following me for years or for minutes. They just show up and say, well, no, I don't think so. Or, yeah, thank you for posting this. This is a great thing. And then we enter a little bit of a conversation. So it's a great thing. But of course, invariably, as Marcus was saying earlier, there is going to be somebody who's going to be nasty. There's going to be somebody who's going to, you know, overreact or whatever it is. And I fail still sometimes. But I remind myself that, look, the reason you're here is, in fact, to be helpful. And to lash back at somebody because they're unhelpful or they're nasty or they're whatever it is, that's not helpful. You always have the possibility of ignoring them. Another, a similar quote from the meditation says, teach them or put up with them, right? It's like, well, that's always an option. I don't have to be on social media, and I certainly don't have to respond to every message that I get. In fact, I don't, because I don't have the time. So it's up to me to be selective about what kind of, the kind of interactions that I want to have. And therefore, when I do choose to spend some time during the day interacting with people, it better be constructive. It better be from the point of view of patience, from the point of view of somebody who wants to be helpful to others. As I said, I don't always succeed. But I'm getting better and better over the years. And Marcus has been very helpful in this regard.
Yeah, that's a good one too. I totally agree with that. I have some of the same struggles sometimes on social media. I don't do Twitter, but I certainly do Facebook. I think I see a couple of names I recognize from some Facebook discussions. And I have too failed to live up to this, right? And I'm reminded Nicholas raised up in the chat, how do you talk to people who refuse to use reason? And I think you just said at a certain point, the answer is you don't.
You don't.
It's, you know, you teach them or you put up with them, right? And not everyone can be brought along, and or maybe just not on that day, right?
Exactly. I was going to say, certainly not necessarily on that day or by you or by using those kind of arguments. They may be brought up on some other day by somebody else.
Yeah.
You know, it's really... we really need to get out of this notion that, especially among academics, is actually fairly widespread. That, well, if I only explain these things to people, then surely they'll understand. And they'll like, no, they don't. Not necessarily. Yeah. Yeah. It depends on where they are, where they're coming from. It depends on how you explain them and how you present them, right? I mean, any kind of snarky remark isn't going to be helpful. You have no idea. Even today, just before getting on the show today, a couple of times I found myself, you know, starting answering somebody on either Twitter or Facebook. And the beginning of the sentence was something like, no, this is wrong, or something along those lines. And then I said, no, don't answer it that way. Because even if I think it's true that what he just said is in fact wrong, if you start your answer with no, chances are that person isn't going to even read the rest of the sentence, right? He's going to immediately think about how can he possibly counter whatever you say. And so try to be more detached, try to be more matter of fact and say, oh, okay, well, here's my opinion. Or here's why I think this way, and then let them do what they do. It's really nonsensical to imagine, even for a minute, that just because we engage people reasonably, that they're necessarily going to change their mind on the spot. I mean, how many times have you changed your mind on the spot in your life? In my experience, is very very little. My own experience.
I've noticed that about you.
Yeah, see, I know. Exactly. I have changed my mind about even sometimes major things. In fact, on my blogs from time to time, I actually publish every few years, I publish a post that says, here's what I changed my mind about you know, over the last few years. But it takes time, because presumably if you have strong opinions about something, it's either because it's very emotionally important for you, or because you spent a lot of time researching and reading about it and formulating your opinions, right? So I don't have any strong opinions about all sorts of topics where I'm perfectly happy to hear what you have to say and say, well, okay, so you think that Mozart is better than Beethoven. Fine. I do prefer the other way around, but I'm not going to make an argument there because it's not my field. On the other hand, if you start telling me that, you know, Darwin was wrong and, you know, the flagellology is correct, then I can go on for an entire day on the other hand.
About the proper interpretation of Enchiridion 4.
There you go, for instance, where, as is well known, you and I disagree.
So. Right.
So the notion is that you never should expect people to change their mind. In fact, it's probably not a good idea if people were to change their mind on a whim, on the basis of, you know, just an immediate reaction. However, that doesn't mean you're wasting time. I mean, I can't tell you, you know, for years I've been, when I was in Tennessee, I was involved in discussions with creationists, for instance. Mm-hmm. And I can't tell you how many times, still today, I get letters, or more likely these days, emails that tell me, you know, we met 10 years ago or 15 years ago, and at the time I had no idea what the hell you were talking about, and I strongly disagree, but over time, I've sort of changed my mind, at least in part, and I want to thank you because what you said that day kind of got me started, or made me, you know, gave me an additional thing to think about that kind of clicked sometimes years later. So sometimes it does work, but just not on the spot.
That's quite right. And sometimes it's not always for the person you're directly engaged with.
Yes.
Right. It can sometimes be an onlooker that is affected by what you do. And one of the things that just underscores everything you've just said is I am responsible for how I behave on social media or otherwise. Right. And I'm not responsible for making others behave in any particular way. And exactly. You know, that's sort of fundamental to all interactions, not just ones on social media. Exactly. I have one more passage I wanted to bring
up. Good, excellent. I have one more too, so you go first.
Okay,
we'll
cool.
Talk about things like, you know, did he persecute the Christians or something?
we'll get there. Maybe. So this is book 9, number 23. Mm. Since you yourself are one of the parts that serve to perfect a social system, let your every action contribute to the perfecting of social life. Any action of yours, then, which has no reference, whether direct or indirect, to these social ends, tears your life apart, prevents it from being at one, and creates division, as does the citizen in a state who, for his own part, cuts himself off from the concord of his fellows. That one jumps out to me as one that really emphasizes something that I think Marcus is really great about emphasizing, but often gets overlooked, and namely the the central and deep social aspect of Stoicism. Mm-hmm. Right? Stoicism so often, even in like some of the passages you and I have read from today, it's easy to sort of, or I think of that Be Like the Headlands example, 449. And it looks like it's this picture of the lone hero standing on the headlands, taking on, you know, shaking his fist at nature. And passages like 923 that I just read remind me that for us, creatures like us, our human nature is social nature. And so Marcus emphasizes here extremely strongly, let your every action be aimed at the common good, the greater good, the social good, right? And otherwise tears your life apart. Mm-hmm. Now, it doesn't always have to be, he's not saying that you have to necessarily give all of your existence to cleaning up litter, right? Or something like that, right? He says direct or indirect. But I think about, the way I treat others in all my interactions, right? Be it with my family, with friends, with my students here online, here doing our online conversations, right? I should be aiming at not just my good, yeah, but the good of everyone insofar as I can.
Yeah, no, that's right. That's exactly right. I mean, when we say things like, you know, we ought to be helping the human cosmopolis, and or Epictetus puts it in a sort of the negative way, you should never do anything to undermine the human cosmopolis. People immediately think, oh, well, who am I to do something about the cosmopolis? I mean, how can I possibly influence the world? Well, the cosmopolis is made of everybody on the planet, including the people you directly influence or come in contact with, right? Your relatives, your friends, your students, your coworkers, you know, have anybody. Those are all members of the human cosmopolis. So long as you behave justly, courageously, you know, temperately, and according to practical wisdom to those, you actually help in the human cosmopolis. It doesn't mean that you have to, you know, be a head of state and be able to stop a war in order to be helpful to the cosmopolis. So yeah, it's a very local. I think one of the things that I appreciate about Stoicism in particular, but also sort of virtue ethics in general, is this notion that runs very much counter to the modern approach to ethics. When we think today of ethics or justice as sort of overarching concept that are kind of imposed, mm-hmm, from the top down, right? So you need a just society, et cetera, moral society, et cetera. For the Stoics and for the virtue ethicists, it actually is a bottom-up kind of thing. Mm-hmm. You make a better world by improving one person at a time. And where are you going to start? You're going to start with yourself, because that's where your agency is maximized.
Well, not even necessarily improving people, improving our relationships with them, that's our right. interactions with them, right? Right? Because what they do, again, not up to us, right? Right? And another thing I think it's really important that comes out in that passage and many others throughout the meditations, and I think Marcus is maybe the best of the Roman Stoics on this point, is that this is not either optional or a part-time job.
Yeah.
Right? That's right. The aiming at the good of the cosmopolis is our duty as members of the cosmopolis, and overrides anything else. Right? And it's easy to forget.
Yeah, exactly. It's easy to forget. And it's also easy to say, and this Seneca talks about this, oh, well, I'll do it in my spare time because, you know, I have to work after all. I have to, you know, get pay my bills and all that. Yeah, but in working, you're also interacting with other people. You're also doing things that are affecting other people. So that's it. You can still practice Stoicism every minute of your life, including when you're working, including when you're on vacation, including when you are relaxing with your friends, all of those opportunities, you know, when you go to a restaurant and you treat people in a certain way or another way, you know, it's that that's it, that it really never stops. And as you say, it's a, it's not a secondary job. It's the, it should be the primary job. Yep. All right. My last quote is from 929, where Marcus says, set yourself in motion if it is in your power, and do not look about you to see if anyone will observe it, nor yet expect Plato's Republic, but be content if the smallest thing goes well, goes on well, and consider such an event to be no small matter. Now, don't wait for Plato's Republic was kind of a common way at the time of saying, don't wait for utopia, right? don't wait until everything is perfect in order to, and this is, remember, the emperor. So this guy really had power to change things on a fairly large scale. And yet he's telling himself, like, you know, any advancement, any progress, no matter how small, is progress. And that's how you make things better, because sometimes even emperors cannot change things dramatically. You cannot overturn an entire system, even if you're an emperor, even if you're a so-called absolute ruler, because there's always a chance that somebody's going to be upset enough to actually eliminate you and undo everything that you've done. And that actually is a nice segue into the next thing that I wanted to talk about before we get to the Christians. And that was the abolishing slavery, the slavery thing. Mm-hmm. So this is an interesting issue. Actually, I'd like to know what you think about not just Marcus in particular, but so the Stoic attitude in general. So there's pretty good evidence, I think, that the Stoics were against slavery, not just in favor of a humane treatment of slaves. We have clear evidence of that. There's a letter by Seneca to Lucilius where he says, you know, the one you call a slave is actually a human being who suffers just like you and he needs to be treated just like you. So that he's clearly striking a note in favor of humane treatment of slaves. But we have fragments from Zeno's Republic where he says explicitly slavery is evil. And so we have scattered commentaries from the Stoics to that effect. And more importantly, perhaps, slavery is clearly contrary to the two basic two of the basic Stoic concepts: cosmopolitanism and philanthropia. Philanthropia meant love of people, love of humanity, right? And cosmopolitanism is this notion that we're all on the same boat together. We're all brothers and sisters, where presumably you don't want your brothers and sisters to be enslaved. So it seems like both in terms of textual evidence and in terms of sort of logic of the philosophy, slavery is in fact incompatible with Stoicism. So, which of course raises the question of, well, here we go now, and we have an emperor who is a Stoic. Why didn't he do anything about this thing, right? And I looked into this a little bit. Don Robertson has actually done quite an analysis on this. There is a really nice paper that he put out about this. But there actually is pretty good evidence that Marcus did do something about slavery. No, he did not abolish it. And the short answer to that is, even if it occurred to him that that could be done or that should be done, it would have been impossible. Slavery was one of the fundamental engines of the Roman economy, just like it was for, by the way, this was not just Roman economy. It was the economy of most large civilizations at the time. I mean, I always cringe a little bit when people bring up the famous example of Spartacus and his slave revolt. In Spartacus, it's an incredibly interesting episode in the history of the late Roman Republic, the revolt of the slaves headed by Spartacus. However, Spartacus is often, you know, naively characterized as, you know, a freedom fighter. And we actually have evidence of the fact that his goal was to go back to Thrace, where he actually was a noble aristocrat, and go back to owning his own slaves. So it's not like he was trying to abolish slavery. He just didn't want personally to be a slave. And that's perfectly understandable, but it doesn't make him into a freedom fighter. So there is that thing. And I want to hear, you know, if you have thoughts about that general idea, you know, would have been possible, you know, should have Marcus tried. But the fact of the matter is that he actually did put out a number of edicts and a number of laws that were explicitly aimed at protecting slaves as much as possible. For instance, one of the things that he did was to make it possible for owners, for masters, to sue the slaves in public court. Now, why would you think that's an improvement? It's an improvement because previously, the owners would simply torture the slaves at their pleasure. Right? If they thought that the slave had done something wrong, they would just torture him or kill him at their pleasure, and there was nothing that anybody could do about it. By moving this to the court system, Marcus basically afforded protection to the slaves. It also made it as easy as possible for slaves to be freed. If there was evidence of a owner pledging, as it was often the case, to eventually free the slave, then the owner could not go back on his word, no matter how much money he would lose into the process. In fact, there is this quote from Marcus, which I think is kind of remarkable, that says, "For principles of humanity demand that a money consideration shall never stand in the way of a person's freedom." I mean, that's remarkable for somebody who was writing, you know, 1900 years ago, close to 900 years ago. But anyway, I'm going to stop there for now and see if you have thoughts about slavery, stoicism, and Marcus.
Yeah. I mean, I think you said a number of things that I think are generally right. I don't know about impossible, right? Right.
Sure.
But I think there's lots of evidence, some of which you pointed out quite explicitly in the Meditations, but in the historical record, that Marcus was an incrementalist.
Yes.
And he was very careful and circumspect. Was it possible that he might have freed all of the slaves? Well, he could have tried. But I think he also knew that that would be a disaster, right? At least in the short term. Antiquity, in general, had, I think for good reasons, had a bunch of people really worried about civil war. Civil war was just about the worst thing, the worst social consequence they could imagine. And I think Marcus was very thoughtful about this, right? And one can think of his example with dealing with Avidius Cassius, the way he dealt with that situation. It was in a very careful, thoughtful way,
right,
to try to avoid civil war. Because I think that doing something that would lead to civil war strikes me, from Marcus's point of view, to be about the most egregious failure of his duty that he could imagine. Mm-hmm. So I think that even though I think you're right that his Stoic principles would lead him to believe that slavery was an egregious wrong, I also think he thinks civil war is an egregious wrong, making decisions that would lead to that. And I think that actually explains another of his major decisions.
That's right. Commodus?
Yeah. Yeah. So so I think it's the same considerations that lead to his careful incrementalist approach to all of his sort of political policies while he was emperor.
Yeah, I agree. Again, on Commodus, on the issue of Commodus, Don Robertson did a very nice job at sort of summarizing all the historical evidence and putting it into context. And we have to remember a couple of things. First of all, arguably one of the main reasons the so-called five good emperors were in fact good emperors is because none of them except Marcus had natural children that survived to adulthood. And so they were forced to pick a successor on the basis of merit, or what they saw as the basis of merit, right? And they picked well. They picked each other. They picked pretty well. I mean, none of them was perfect. You know, Adrian had his own idiosyncrasies, especially near the end of his life.
Yes, he did.
But, you know, Antoninus Pius actually arguably was, I think, the best of them, even perhaps. Maybe he was lucky to some extent because he didn't have to deal with a plague and a couple of wars, but his reign was very, very peaceful and, you know, and marked by, you know, the highest peak of sort of justice by the standards of the time.
Well, I think you could make an argument about Antoninus Pius that his reluctance to act is what led to some of the difficulties that Marcus had to face.
That is true. That's a good point. See, you just changed my mind. On the spot.
Put it on your blog.
On my blog. So that does explain to a large extent the choice of Komodos, because Komodos, in fact, I think Marcus had 15 children, several males, only one adult male, only one survived to adulthood, and that was Komodos. But the other thing is, actually, Marcus made a number of plans that didn't really focus on Komodos himself. For instance, Komodos was raised to Caesar when he was only 7, I think. So there were these two ranks, right? Imperator, the big guy, Marcus, and then the Caesar. Caesar was a sort of a lower rank, which usually often was going to be seen in the line of succession to eventually replace the Imperator. And for one thing, Marcus actually was the first Roman emperor that had a co-emperor. That would be Lucius Verus. And when he raised Commodus to the level of Caesar, he also did that with one, at least, of Lucius Verus' children. And the notion, presumably, I mean, we don't have direct evidence of this, but the notion presumably was that eventually Marcus would die first because Lucius was younger and healthier. Marcus had always been a little on the sickly side, and he was older. And so the notion would have been that, Lucius would have been in charge, and he eventually would have had either one his son or Commodus as a co-emperor, grooming him and so on and so forth. But the fact is, Lucius died of the plague. And so that left Marcus all of a sudden in sole control of the empire, and he had to revise his plans. But in fact, the thing that I really find fascinating is that Marcus was, in fact, very famous and controversially so for favoring a meritocracy as opposed to sort of inheritance of things. In particular, for instance, he raised very high one of his commanders in Germany, on the German frontier, Tiberius Claudius Pompeianus. And in fact, he married him to his daughter Lucilla, who was the widow of Lucius Verus. Now, Lucilla was referred to as Augusta, so she was the most powerful woman in Rome. And that put Pompeianus straight into the line of succession. Right? The thing is, Pompeianus is this unusual man who refused the crown 3 times, not once, but 3 times. He refused to be raised Caesar by Marcus. And then after Commodus was killed, he was asked by Pertinax to become emperor, and he refused. So Pertinax stepped up instead. And then after Pertinax came a guy named Julianus, who also asked Pompeianus to become emperor, and Pompeianus refused. So it's not like there were no other additional or at least complementary plans in motion. It's just that fate is what it is. And in the end, we got stuck with Commodus.
Well, and I also think it was really important. I mean, so yeah, I don't think anybody thought Commodus was the best man for the job.
Right.
But I also think, going back to my earlier point, it was so important for Marcus to leave a clear line of succession.
Yes.
Right? So his successor had to be clear. To not have a clear line of succession was almost to invite civil war over that line of succession, and he wanted very badly to avoid that.
In fact, it did. This actually did happen in, I believe it was 306. I forgot the name of the emperor, but one of the later emperors actually did pick the best men for the job, right? It did a meritocratic succession, ignoring his own offspring, and the result was 18 years of civil war.
Exactly.
So I'm pretty sure, and there were precedents before Marcus. So I think Marcus knew. Often people point, for instance, to the first emperor Augustus, who was not, picked by lineage, because he was adopted by Julius Caesar. But again, that was because Caesar did not have offspring, male offspring of his own. And so at that point, that becomes pretty clear how to do things, because, well, you don't have an option. But if there is an option at the time, if there was an option of somebody who was actually in your lineage and you bypassed them, that was guaranteed to start a civil war, because that person would not have gone. Either that, or Don Robertson makes an interesting point. The only other option that Marcus would have had was to kill Commodus, had Commodus killed.
That's right. Yeah, I think that's
and
right.
That's something that a Stoic wouldn't do, kill your own offspring, who is in fact innocent at the time, because remember, when Commodus became emperor, he was only 19.
Yep.
Right. So he was a pretty young fellow. And, you know, you're just going to eliminate him because you think that it might be not good enough. It's like that seems like a very strange criterion to apply.
I think that's right.
So, all right, we got a few more minutes. Should we talk about the Christians?
Sure. I mean, I think we're going to say some of the same things, right? I mean, Marcus was a man of principle, right? Yeah. And his principles were led him to incrementalism, led him to want to aim at the unity of the Roman Empire, which is his role as emperor within the cosmopolis, right? So.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it's kind of satisfying, actually, when the same set of expiatory principles apply to a number of different situations, right? So there has been this thing among the Christian tradition that blame Marcus for persecutions. It seems to be the case that the frequency of local persecutions against Christians did increase during Marcus' reign. However, the scholars that have looked into this seem also to agree that this was not Marcus' doing. Right? You have to remember that he was, as again, sole emperor of a vast, by this point, territory, which, of course, was mostly governed by the local governors. And yes, the governors were responsible, to the emperor, and they were appointed by the emperor. But that doesn't mean that the emperor had control over everything that these people were doing. Incidentally, let's remember that Christianity at the time was, as Marcus himself referred to it, that small Jewish sect.
Yeah,
right? Right. It wasn't really that important in the general scheme of things. Right. The emperor wasn't going to waste a lot of time on yet another little group that was making a little bit of trouble locally. But there are a couple of things that I think are interesting in terms of sort of Marcus and the Christians. For one thing, we have a letter by him to the governors of Asia, of the general province of Asia, which was really what we would today consider the Middle East and Near Asia, where he explicitly said, hey, I've heard that some of you guys go after these Christians people. Don't. You have to do it only if they actually are guilty of plotting against the Roman state. If not, you cannot go after them just because of what they believe. And in fact, if somebody brings charges against a Christian and those charges happen to be turn out to be unfounded, that person should be persecuted.
Yep.
So that's pretty damn good evidence that Marcus, in his own, didn't really have anything against the Christians. And in fact, he was trying to do his best. They were just one among many, many groups that he had to deal with. And, with a couple of wars going on and a pestilence and all that sort of stuff, I'm pretty sure that the little Jewish sect there was not very high in his
No, mind. He was much more concerned with groups like the Marcomanni.
Yes, exactly.
Right? There are plenty of minority groups in Rome at the time that he had to deal with, and the Christians were a very small one. I think that's certainly right. And... go ahead.
Yeah, no. So I think we cleared pretty much the agenda. We went through several of our favorite passages on Marcus and kind of summarized his take on Stoic philosophy and why it has been influential on the two of us in particular. We talked about the Christians, we talked about slavery, we talked about Commodus. I think I'm pretty happy.
Yeah, we did it. Happy birthday, Marcus.
Happy birthday, Marcus. Exactly. And I hope that people enjoyed it and that they will be back for the next episode of the Stoa Nova Conversations, which I'm going to remind you will take place on, when is it? May 9th at 1 p.m. Yeah. Eastern time. And we'll be honored to have Anthony Long as our guest. He is the author of major works on Hellenistic philosophy in general, Stoicism in particular, and Epictetus even more in particular. So I'm very much looking forward to that. It's only 2 weeks down the road. And so until then, stay safe, everybody. And nice to see you, Rob.
Nice to see you, Massimo. Thanks, everybody, for joining us on this auspicious birthday.